This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Georgery Bledsoe is the youngest of 17 children. Family didn't have a lot of money, but she was exposed to many things as a child, including Girl Scouts, ballet lessons, and music. And the adults in her small community encouraged her to take leadership roles, especially when it came to music. Her music teacher in elementary school pushed her to play piano to accompany the class. And then when she was in junior high, her piano teacher sent her around to local churches to fill in for organists or music directors. Well, music became a focal point of her upbringing and is still central to her mission today. She's the founder and executive director of BUMP, a Triangle-based nonprofit music education organization, and much, much more. We'll talk about that and a lot more as we learn your journey. Georgery Bledsoe, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's an honor to be here.
Great to have you here. Talk about growing up in East St. Louis among 16 siblings and a pair of parents.
Well, you know, East St. Louis is actually known as a good place to be from, if you know what I mean. When I was growing up there, it was sort of considered the crime capital of the country. And I have to say, there were a lot of challenges. There were a lot of traumatic things going on around me and my family. But my parents were very strict. They were determined that their children would receive the benefits. You know, a lot of times we look at inner city situations and we don't look at the positive things. My mission is to really look at the assets in situations like that. And I had a lot of them. My piano lessons with Miss Margie, that was just one of the most amazing experiences of my upbringing.
Well, talk about that, because if you think about piano lessons, growing up in a family without a lot of money, we can talk about the entrepreneurial nature of your father, who kept it going very well. But still, even in a family with a little bit more money, sending everybody to music lessons, not easy. And
yeah.
You went.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, it's amazing to me that my parents decided to make the investment in sending all of us to piano lessons. And I had to question, why was that? Of course, I understand that now. But another part of it was this sort of bartering that went on in a community like East St. Louis. My teacher wasn't always requiring that my parents paid up constantly. Some students brought soil for her garden. My sisters helped out in the kitchen. She was determined to make sure the families who needed lessons got them.
And she saw something in you. Is that fair to say? And she really did kind of push you. And talk more about her influence on you and your relationship.
So she was the music director at my church growing up in East St. Louis. And she was also the organist for the National Baptist Convention. So she had all these connections. I didn't know all this at the time. But the way she set up these connections locally and nationally gave me all these opportunities. For instance, I was the pianist at BTU, Baptist Training Union, at church. There were all these little churches around the region who needed substitutes or some who just didn't have a choir director. And to prepare me to go out and play in these situations, I had to bike over to her house for lessons in the dark on Saturday morning, before the sun came up on Saturday mornings, to take lessons and be prepared. Some of these little churches I would go to for rehearsals on, you know, in the evenings. It was a little scary because I'd have to get in a taxi. And, you know, taxis in those days didn't just take you directly where you were going. There were a bunch of people in there. So you went all these different places before you got to where you were going. And I'm just a child. So.
And this was, as you say, a fairly dangerous neighborhood at that time still.
Yes.
So all that's going through. Let's tell this story from two points of view. Miss Margie must have seen something to put you in a position and to spend that much time preparing you for positions that were going to reflect on her. She must have thought you were pretty good.
She had a small group of students that she saw potential in. And after my private lesson on Saturday mornings, then I was joined by several others where we used to practice gospel style. We would listen to each other. So, she sort of called out this group of students that she saw potential in.
Now, let's tell the story from your point of view. Did you see this as an honor or was this a burden? How much of this did you actually like?
You know, as a child in a family of 17, you really did what you needed to do. And the way my parents raised us, you did what you were told to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking back on it, I understand that there was a lot that I learned and it was a great experience. But there were some challenges at the time. I think one of the challenges was that I really never saw anything, any of the money that I earned from these. You know, my parents needed every bit that was coming into the household to take care of us.
And so, and what about the music itself? Were you, you're telling me that, you know, to a certain extent, it's a matter of duty. But were you bringing on board? Because we're going to talk more about your attachment to gospel music. But I wonder what your feeling about the music was at the time in your heart.
Oh, well, then now that's a different story. I just love music. Because of what was going on around me, sometimes I just sit down at the piano at home, hoping my fingers could do more than they could. But music was a solace for me. And, you know, there were so many different kinds of experiences at these little churches I go to. One of them was a holiness church, and I'm trying my best to improvise. And another one was this church that just did hymns out of the hymnal. And there were a lot of great experiences.
And you were still trying your best to improvise, but you knew better, right?
Well, I didn't have to improvise there.
a little bit of a flourish right here wouldn't hurt this hymn. But talk about that. You also talked about the fact that your parents were strict. They had some very sharp, real ideas and well-defined ideas about what each of the 17 of you were going to do, and they were going to see that you did it. And then tragedy struck. You lost your sister when she was in her teens. You were much younger. And that really had an impact on the way they raised you, right, from that point forward.
Absolutely. You know, as hard as they tried to keep all of us safe from what was going on around us, my sister sort of fell in with the wrong crowd. And when I was about 8 or 9 years old, she was 17, and she'd run away from home. I would see her from time to time across town, and it was clear that she wasn't doing well. And then when she was 17, she was killed in a car accident. And after that, my parents were even more strict on me.
What was that like for you at the time? You said you were, 9 years old, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So not only is there the loss of your sister, but you're trying to somehow interpret and internalize what they're doing here. It must have been difficult for you to.
It was. It was heartbreaking, and it was challenging.
How did that things change? Because it sounds like they were already pretty strict and demanding, but in terms of the way they treated you and your sense of freedom, I suppose, 9, 10, 11 years old. How did you see your life from that time forward?
Well, you know, at this point, they were just really clear about how our time would be used. We went to church. We went to piano lessons. I went to theory lessons. I went to Girl Scouts. I went to ballet. I went to charm class. They just regimented the time and made sure we were, you know, one of the really fun things that happened in elementary school is my siblings were playing in a junior high school band. And since I was in elementary, you know, of course, I wasn't a part of that, but I had to go to rehearsal with them one day. This is during the summer. And I wanted to play in that band so badly. So I went to the band director and said, I want to play in this band. He said, well, what do you play? At the time, I was only playing violin and piano. And it's a band, so there are no violin or piano parts. So he pulled out a xylophone. And I was able to play with the junior high school band that summer. I remember playing the Sloopchon B. So, you know.
You could do it all. And eventually you were persuaded to apply to Stanford in high school. Now, that's interesting because, first of all, they recognized again not only your musical talent, but this now your intellectual talent. They wanted you to go to Stanford when you were in high school, right?
Yes. You know, my high school, and we moved from East St. Louis to Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles, called Watts at the time. And they put me in, you know, sort of the basic classes. I think they made assumptions about us having come from East St. Louis. Well, my mother wasn't having it. She came up to the school and she demanded that I be put in the most advanced classes. And this included calculus class before school, science club after school. And one day I was pulled aside by a guidance counselor. She said, "We have some puzzles we want you to do." And I love puzzles. So she just put these in, put these puzzles in front of me. And I was like, chook, 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 chook. Well, come to find out, it was actually an IQ test. So they came back and said, "You've got this IQ of, you know, it's like 164, 165. And we think you can get into Stanford." I'd never heard of Stanford. I was planning to go to Cal State Northridge. So I said, okay, I'll apply. And I did and got in.
There is a whole story, a whole other hour in the ways in which particularly children of color are misplaced in elementary school and mistracked. And we were about to lose you to that whole system. Your mother intervened, and in a lot of cases that doesn't happen. And you ended up in Stanford, and we'll hear the rest of that story on The State of Things when my conversation with Georgerie Bledsoe continues, the founder and executive director of BUMP, a Triangle nonprofit music education organization. We'll continue our conversation on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Music played a central role in Georgerie Bledsoe's upbringing, and one of her biggest influences was her piano teacher, Miss Margie. Her family moved from East St. Louis, and Miss Margie, when Georgerie was in high school, landed in L.A., where lots of older siblings had already settled. Today, music is still central to her life. She's the founder and executive director of BUMP, a Triangle nonprofit music education organization. So we get you from East St. Louis to Watts. We find out that they're about to put you in regular classes because they assume that everybody from East L.A., or most of the kids, that's where they belong. Your mother wasn't having it.
Nope.
She gets you put into the advanced classes, and sure enough, they find out that you're a pretty bright student, suggest that you apply to Stanford, and you do, and you get in.
Yeah.
And you major in music? No, engineering.
Well, my brother's a chemical engineer and a civil engineer said that since I was good in math and science, I should really major in engineering because that's where the money is.
Well, I mean, that's a smart thing to say. How'd that go? You went there for a few years anyway.
I did. I majored in civil engineering for a couple of years. I worked for Caltrans during the summer. And it wasn't really, actually, I sort of stopped out. Not because of the major, but because of finances, and got married.
What about music? What role is music playing in your life in those years?
I wasn't in my undergraduate years before I stopped out. I wasn't doing a lot of music, and that may be the reason civil engineering didn't work for me. I did sing in the gospel choir at Stanford, but I think, things came back together once I came back to Stanford.
Talk about that. You went to New York with your fiance and didn't finish, but then you did come back to Stanford a couple of years later. Talk more about that.
So when we got back to Stanford, I ended up having, after getting married, ended up having four kids in the space of 5 years. So
that's a family tradition.
So when my spouse finished his MBA, then I was able to go back when the kids were ages 5 and 1.
Yeah.
The range
to be much easier then.
And at that point, I majored in music. I was studying full time. I did really well. And it was clear to me that's what I needed to study.
And you had an advisor who advised you to get a PhD in ethnomusicology. Am I right?
Yes. After I finished my bachelor's degree, when the kids were a little older, he asked what I was going to do when I finished the degree. And I said I wanted to be a music teacher because I had taught the after-school music program at a private international prep school called the Harker School. And he said, no, you can't do that. You're really good at this. You need to get a PhD in ethnomusicology. I agreed to study for a master's degree. And so I applied for a master's program at Stanford, but I was admitted to the PhD program.
Hmm. So how did that go for you? And how much did you, I mean, were you happy with that choice at the time?
I really enjoyed it. You know, this is sort of a period where I'm learning the total flip side of what I've been immersed in as a child, right? I'm in this very Afrocentric musical upbringing. And then I go to Stanford, and things are totally Eurocentric. I'm writing about the Chopin Preludes. It's that I wrote my master's thesis on, and I love all of this music.
Were you aware at the time, because we're going to talk more about the Afrocentric music that you were raised with and why you think it's so important now to be teaching that. When you are learning about the great white composers whose music is indeed wonderful, were you sort of conscious of these two worlds and the ways in which one dominated our consciousness as a culture?
I'll tell you what I was conscious of. My first month on campus at Stanford was culture shock for me. I grew up speaking Ebonics. And I was in a dorm with Black middle-class kids, and I opened my mouth to speak, and everyone turned and looked at me. And I realized that I needed to learn a few things in order to fit in at Stanford. So my whole Stanford experience was about learning a culture that I wasn't familiar with. I wasn't taking the time to determine, is this culture oppressive? I was learning what I needed to survive.
And you did that, and then you're working on your thesis, which, as you said, was on Chopin's Preludes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
And you do that. And in the meantime, you move to Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yep.
Now, talk about that experience, because that, I think, did start to change a little bit of your consciousness.
It did. So my spouse took a job at IBM. And we moved before I finished my master's degree, but the academic advisor who'd been so encouraging told me he was retiring, and that motivated me to finish my master's thesis very quickly. But after my kids started school, after we moved to Chapel Hill, I started to see a few things that were disturbing. I was at a party with some people in the neighborhood, and a neighbor took me aside and said, I hear you talking about how you helped found a PTA and you were a PTA president, but you're not going to be listened to at the PTA meetings here because you're Black. I had my kids telling me that their friends were saying, well, our white friends don't want us to interact with our Black friends. And there were all these racially tinged incidents that really were bracing. And I saw that my kids were a part of all the advanced classes, but there were so many capable, brilliant Black kids who were being tracked in remedial classes. So the impact for me was two things. One, I wanted to see if I couldn't have an impact on the way kids at Chapel Hill High and the school district were being tracked. And two, I now wanted my scholarship to count for something to make an impact on this racial divide.
What did you do? What did you do on each of those fronts?
So on the front of tracking at Chapel Hill High, I founded the Minority Achievement Support Committee. And there were faculty, staff, parents, and we really talked about ways that we could help students understand what their options were and what services were available. Because I think, you know, a lot of times they're not really made aware of all the wonderful things they could have. So we got our agenda into the school improvement plan, and we also created a position at Chapel Hill High, the advocacy specialist.
How open were they? Because I have found that there is a certain open, when implicit bias is the problem, there is a kind of an openness to sort of wake up and make some changes that would be appropriate. Doesn't always happen. But there can be an openness to change when the problem is implicit bias. What did you find?
Well, we found some pushback because I think people don't always see the disparate outcomes and don't make the connection between the actions that we take with those outcomes. And so that's what we helped people to see.
And on the other front, change in your academic focus. Tell us about that.
That's right. So having done a master's on the Chopin Preludes, my expectation was to study 19th century piano music for my PhD. But, you know, in thinking about how my scholarship could serve to reflect the relevance of Black kids in our society and be a door to scholarship for them, I was beginning to think about some sort of African-American music to study. Well, that's when my piano teacher, Miss Marchie, passed away. And I went to East St. Louis. I was asked to go through her home because she had these stacks of music all over the place to see if there was anything of value to be saved. Oh, my goodness. I found a collection of gospel sheet music there that was larger than what they had at the Schomburg Center for Black Music in New York, the Schomburg Library, yeah, and at the Center for Black Music Research in Chicago.
This is Miss Margie's sheet music that she's got hanging around the house.
Yes, goodness. Absolutely.
What'd you think when you saw it?
Well, it's because she's at the forefront of the gospel music industry. She's a pioneer. She's accompanied Thomas Dorsey. She's accompanied Mahalia Jackson. She's traveled with them. She's going to the conventions where all this music is available, and she's saving everything. So I realize there's a story to be told here, and I'm starting to interview people in the area. There was another gentleman, George Holloway, whose sheet music collection was actually larger than hers. And his LP collection was used by the local radio station. And he ensured that I got his collection before he passed away.
So what did you do with all of this?
So I wrote my dissertation on this, this community, Metropolitan St. Louis Gospel Community. And I learned that there were three kinds of networks that I was looking at here. There are apprenticeship networks, there are publishing networks, and then there are performing networks. And so I cataloged the gospel sheet music collections. Those are in my dissertation. I have the photocopies of all of Ms. Margie's collection, as well as the collection of Mr. Holloway. It was the apprenticeship connections that really I found compelling, because that's what brought me full circle to understand that the opportunities I got to perform around town and the training I got were impactful beyond measure in my personal life. I would not have been able to enter a music degree at Stanford without this training. This is the only training I had before I entered the music department at Stanford, and I was more than well prepared. Plus, I had this level of confidence that was brought about because of my immersion in my own culture.
And then you find out that it wasn't just accidental or incidental, but in fact, you were part of a long line, a trajectory, a genealogy of apprenticeships that have been going on for a long time and sending other children into other parts of American life.
Absolutely. That's what the gospel music industry is built on. So, you know, you're starting this new industry from scratch, and people like Thomas Dorsey are composing these songs and creating the sheet music and traveling around the country directing local choirs like the choirs at my church. And I can remember a train of gospel musicians coming through my church, building these relationships and looking at the music and performing it in all these different ways. And everybody really digging into the gospel music style through these personal relationships.
This is amazing because, of course, we're all familiar with gospel music, and we might know the name of Thomas Dorsey and the people who've put the music to publish the music and put it in print and saved it for us. We might be aware of that tradition, but what you're saying is that this is a deeper tradition that has business and cultural roots, apprenticeships. It's a system. It is much more systematic than we thought. Had anyone written about this before?
Horace Boyer wrote a book called The Sound of Gospel Music. I'm going to get that title a little bit wrong. But he focused on the gospel highway. And so he talked about all these places along the gospel highway. So I sort of picked up that theme to say, what is the relationship between everyone on the gospel highway? Because it was these relationships that helped to really make the industry strong.
When you do this, I mean, your head must be exploding now as you start to imagine the deeper connection that this has and the deeper contributions that gospel is making to American culture than any of us had thought. What are your reflections and what were you learning in terms of the takeaway, but some of the more important concepts and ideas that you came away with as a result of your research?
You know, Frank, I decided that, I could see that the apprenticeship networks in particular were something that was being lost. And as I interviewed people, I could see that they were being lost. The gospel music industry is, you know, taking a different direction. And I thought, if we can take the lessons learned from this and bring it into the 21st century, this could be really powerful for kids and communities like mine.
Well, we're going to talk about BUMP, which is the program that you created that I think does address this directly, but we have left a few loose ends, like what happens to Miss Margie's collection and also the record collection, all of this material that you've amassed.
So the Miss Margie's Gospel Sheet Music Collection is owned by her godson's daughter, who I believe lives in Chicago now. The sheet music collection from George Holloway, I own, and it's housed in the music department at Duke. I also own the LP collection that's housed in the music department at Duke. Unfortunately, the radio station did not return all of his LPs.
Never trust a radio station. That's my motto. You go on, and what's interesting is you decide to change the focus of your academic work now to precisely the subjects that we've been talking about. And you're at Brandeis University, right, at this point? But you were actually discouraged at one point, right?
Well, you know, I wasn't sure that I wanted a career in academe when this position for the Mellon postdoc at Brandeis came up. I was encouraged to just put my name in the hat, test the academic waters. I really did not expect to get the position. And I really didn't expect to be discouraged when one of the people at Brandeis interviewed me and said, well, Georgerie, I don't think gospel music is worthy of study. I think we should have a jazz scholar for this position.
Wow. luckily, that individual turned out to be wrong, but what were you thinking at the time when you heard that?
Well, the interview was supposed to be brief, 15 or 20 minutes, but I launched into a 30 to 40 minute tirade. Not a tirade, just explaining to him why it was wrong.
It would turn into a tirade pretty quickly, I would think, but okay, however you want to characterize it. You were there, I wasn't. After this two-year postdoc, that things start to really change for you in some very different ways. Your marriage ended. You did not want to come back to North Carolina right away, so you took a position at Tufts, right?
Right.
But things did change, and you ended up back here. So talk about those years. They had to be difficult years for you.
I didn't want to come right back to Chapel Hill after the postdoc, given the fact that my marriage had ended. And so I was very lucky that I was able to land the position at Tufts University. But unfortunately, a lot of things were on me at that time, and I ended up having health problems. And I decided, you know, it's really time to take stock of what I should be doing and what I want to be doing. And so it's that time that I started BUMP.
Is that what brought you back to North Carolina? Talk about why that soul searching brought you back here to North Carolina?
Well, I was doing Bump. I founded Bump in Boston and was doing Bump. But, you know, it was really exploratory, trying to understand what does this look like in the 21st century, trying different sorts of things. And then the financial crisis really just took the legs out from under what we were
Let's pause
doing.
There and describe Bump for us and the program that you designed in New England.
So Bump empowers youth through music of the African diaspora. And in Boston, we got a grant from Ed Vesters to have our program in the public schools there. And so it was a wonderful opportunity for young people who were immersed in this tradition to begin to share their talents. And it's out of the work that we did that we started to concretize what it really looks like.
And what did the program look like? What are the kids learning in this program?
So we had a focus on the history and culture of music of the African diaspora. And you can't stand in front of K through 8th graders and talk about history and culture, right? So we created all these hands-on activities and games to really immerse kids and help them to connect with what the culture means historically and in their current everyday lives.
We'll talk more about that, how it worked in Boston and how it's working here in North Carolina when my conversation with Georgerie Bledsoe continues. She's founder and executive director of Bump, a Triangle-based nonprofit music education organization. More to come. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow talking to Georgerie Bledsoe, founder and executive director of Bump, a Triangle-based nonprofit music education organization that focuses on music of the African diaspora. We had you in Boston creating this program, trying to teach all of the cultural foundations of music that has found its way to America and ultimately informs all of our culture. And you said the financial crisis of 2008 hit. So what effect did that have on you?
Well, you know, before that hit, we started out, or I should say, I started out by just accepting the opportunities that came along. A principal at one of the elementary schools said, well, would you come and teach a before school choir? And so I was teaching the choir and bringing these iconic songs of African-American music And that's when I sort of realized that the kids needed that to be contextualized, if that was going to have a deeper meaning. So that's when I began to create these worksheets. And so we had a performance of the choir. And the principal came to me and said, Georgerie, the kids sing wonderfully and it's just beautiful, but it's these worksheets that we feel are really impactful with them. And so that's how I knew that it was important to begin to build out that history and culture part.
So what's on the worksheets?
So it talks about for instance, with Lift Every Voice and Sing, it talks about not just the actual history of the date of the composition and the birth and death date of the composers, but how they worked together, how the Johnson brothers worked together to create the song, the fact that they cried when they finished creating that, the ways that people in our culture have taken Lift Every Voice and Sing and used that title to have tentacles into all different parts of the culture, right? So we have a book called Lift Every Voice and Sing, 100 Years, 100 Voices. This is a book where 100 people, politicians, artists, have said how impactful that song has been in their lives.
Why do you think it is? Because you talked about in the last segment the fact that it's pretty tough to get K through 12 students to sit still for that kind of cultural education.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the teachers are coming to you saying, this is the thing they really love. What happened? Mm-hmm. How did they sit still for that kind of education?
So I'll give you an example of a lesson that we do. It's the happy birthday lesson, Stevie Wonder's Happy Birthday. And it never ceases to amaze me how many people still don't know that that song was used to make Dr. King's birthday a holiday, right? So we have a slideshow where we sort of quickly go through the timeline of that history. But then we make the timeline real. Every one of the children gets a piece of that timeline on a card. It belongs to them. And then they have to work with each other to put that timeline in the right order. Then we have the karaoke activity, where they get a poster, they get all the lyrics of the song, and each group of kids has a different verse of the song. So this group has to listen and put the lyrics of that verse in the right order, and now you have karaoke posters where each group can sing the verse that they've put in the right order. They're very familiar with those lyrics by now, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, they're raring to go to sing the song. And then we have an opportunity for them to talk about issues in their own neighborhood, and they can create poetry to the song, to the melody of the song that they can sing.
So not only are these kids learning about the music itself, but and its important role in the context that it has played in developing American culture, which would be plenty,
yes.
but quite subversively, Georgia, in the process that you used, you're also teaching the process by which this music was made. It was a community. It was a community that fostered apprenticeships, fostered businesses, fostered artistic creativity in community, and that's what kept us all together.
And so it is subversive, because you don't have to come to a child and tell them what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You just live out musically. For us, this is the expressive value and culture of music of the African diaspora. So the reason we're doing this is because kids are getting a Eurocentric approach to music, right? And with multicultural music, they're getting the sampling of music from other cultures, but they're still approaching that music in a Eurocentric fashion. So we're saying, but how did Black communities actually approach education? And then we're doing that.
And integrating it as well. You know, the idea that it is not something we've added to white culture or European culture, but in fact it has created the American culture. It's not an additive, a thing that you put next to it, but the thing that is in fact created what it is to be an American.
So, you know, we use the term music of the African diaspora because there are all these expressive values that came to the U.S., Europe, Asia, and all these other countries with the African people that traveled around the world, right? And so we think of these as the seeds that landed in the sociocultural soil. So for the U.S., those seeds have all sorts of things that they're responding to in the soil. And so those values get expressed in different ways. And I need to write more about this, but I think the talking drum is a perfect metaphor for the African diaspora, because this is an instrument that mimics the spoken word. And then the talking drums are brought to the U.S., but they're outlawed when the quote-unquote masters understand that, you know, Africans can communicate with each other, but that communication simply gets transformed into the coded language of the spirituals. It gets transformed into the way that blues chronicles the history of a people. All these genres of African-American music are very much rooted and grounded in music of the African diaspora. And as you said, they are also the core of American music. And so we don't always take the time to understand the roots of this core of American music. And this is important for everyone, not just African-American children.
How far back do you go in teaching the roots? You talked about the talking drum. I assume the banjo is going to be part of this. How much of African soil do you turn to teach this? And then it would seem to me a great opportunity to talk about African cultures, about which we know very little, and what we know is probably wrong.
Absolutely. So what we like to do is have instructors with a whole range of expertise. So we have instructors with expertise in African music, all these different genres, so that we are not just coming from, so I'm a musicologist and I'm studying gospel. I can't do justice to African music. It's important if we're going to really understand these cultures that we go to the source. And so in terms of how much, yes, we see this as a huge project that can only grow.
And it talks about kingdoms that were alive and thriving in Africa, out of which this musical tradition, all of that cultural history, while you're talking about the instruments, has been lost to us as Americans. We don't get much of that in our history classes.
It's not completely lost. I mean, there are a lot of Jeles who still carry the traditions from centuries ago. And we have families here in Durham who still carry these traditions. So the Triangle is just a wonderful place to be in terms of being able to tap into many traditions.
And you talked about the importance of this for all Americans to learn, not just African Americans. Talk about BUMP and who is part of the program, who participates.
So BUMP has three main programs. The first is BUMP Out. Our largest program is BUMP Out. This is where we take our workshops and residencies into schools, into public housing sites, wherever the kids are. So we are CAPS artists, and that's how many of the schools bring in our programs. We also have a partnership with the Durham Housing Authority, where we've served children at 6 public housing sites for over 2 years, and homeless shelters. And then the second program is GRIO Summer Camp. This is a STEAM program. So the kids are doing music, arts, and arts technology. And they're weaving all of that into these amazing projects in 1 week of camp. And then our newest program is called Ubuntu Music Academy. This is where kids learn their musical instrument. We had a pilot program of that earlier this year. And in one semester, the kids were able to perform with the Durham Symphony Orchestra at our signature program in June.
That's got to be huge. I mean, the ability to perform this music and to play it, which is, of course, what you were doing as a young girl growing up and what blossomed into quite a career, has to be amazing for these kids.
This Ubuntu Music Academy is the program that we want to grow because it's the one where the kids have the contact hours. They're able to really master their musical instrument, and it's going to be the one where we see the impact over the years and we can do the longitudinal studies.
It's a fascinating program. We'll have to talk more about that, and I think probably hear some samples as our program goes forward in the months ahead. But I want to take a turn in our conversation now and bring us back in a sense, because one of the themes that runs through your story is some of the challenges that people who grew up in neighborhoods like yours have for blossoming and end up having a career like yours, how unlikely it is in some cases. East St. Louis was home to Monsanto Corporation, which dumped an awful lot of its poison in East St. Louis, and people are suffering. You just lost a brother, and it's one of 3 siblings who you have lost to a disease that's been associated with some of these toxins. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so Monsanto at the time was headquartered in East St. Louis, and I learned about a class action suit against the Monsanto some years ago. Most of the people, or just multiple myeloma was just one of the main cancers that people were getting because of that toxic dumping. I've lost 3 siblings now with that disease. I have another who's living with it, and I have another sibling who's starting to have symptoms of that.
Talk about the suit and the fact that, has there been a reckoning? Because this sense of environmental justice, that is a topic that's, it's sometimes very difficult to promote, the idea that there are certain neighborhoods, particularly neighborhoods that don't have the voice and don't have the wealth to fight back, are the ones that find themselves bearing the biggest burden of this kind of waste.
So unfortunately, because we'd moved from East St. Louis back in the 70s, we didn't hear about the class action suit until it was all already underway. And so we weren't able to join it. And I think it's actually still going on. I don't think it's over.
Right. As you look back over your career and think about all of the twists and turns that it has taken, how do you reflect on this? It's not over yet by a long shot, but but at this point in your career, how do you reflect on it?
Well, you know, Frank, my parents were all about the future and giving back. It's funny, they were poor, but they were all about giving back. I mean, as poor as they were, they managed to save money and help my brother, the one who just most recently passed away, help him start one of the first Black-owned supermarkets in the country in Los Angeles. And so because of the way I was raised, I don't focus on the negative and the challenges. I focus on the potential and what we can do.
There's a way in which that plays into a kind of exceptionalism. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. The fact that we say, well, Georgia did it. So what are all these complaints? Why do we need special programs? Why do we need to focus special attention? And what's all this about environmental justice? Look, if you have the determination and your parents are behind you, any American can make it. Is that the story here?
Sure, that's the story here. There were so many people in East St. Louis who had as much as or more potential than I have. And so having an institution like Miss Margie's music studio makes all the difference. So what if we had more of those, right? We could be harvesting so much more potential.
So that's why collecting the history and contextualizing it, because Miss Margie was doing it on the ground every day, living part of that network. But the idea that you'll contextualize it and sort of be more self-conscious about the way you can promote a program seems to me to add value, particularly in an environment where we're losing so much of this.
Yeah, I don't know where the exceptionalism argument comes from exactly. Because if you're coming from a place where you want to see potential realized, then your goal is to help make that happen. Those who are on the more resourced end of society have the resources from, you know, all sorts of different places. Right. And so our job is to resource the areas who don't have it.
And that's how programs like BUMP contribute. I would guess. George Reed Bledsoe, founder and executive director of BUMP, a Triangle nonprofit music education organization. George Reed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Frank, for having me.
You can find out more about her work and the program at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.